Thank you, Mr. Evans, and good afternoon, everyone. It's been a little while since I have been in Indy for services. I was commenting to some folks beforehand. I think the last time I was in Indianapolis for church services was for a YU basketball tournament. So that's some of that church in speak. Some of you know what I mean when I say a YOU basketball tournament. If you don't, ask your parents. Classes have been very, very fruitful this week for us. It's been great to have these. I want to thank the administration for putting them together for us. It's been reassuring to be able to sit down with some of the other newbies and some of the other folks who are just a few years into it and hear some of the experiences, some of the questions, some of the thoughts that everyone's had. It's been quite comforting, and the classes have been great. I will tell, let you know quickly here, I've been sitting right next to Mr. Bornhurst. He's been taking very, very good notes. So you'll be glad to know he's going to come back with all sorts of new things to try out on him. Just kidding. Just kidding. A little boy came running into church one day, very late, later than normal. And the greeter there at the door noticed this. He thought it was a little unusual. He was normally always there 10, 15 minutes ahead of time, but he was a little late that day. And as he came in, the greeter there asked him, said, "Oh, is everything okay?" And he said, yeah, everything's fine, but, well, kind of ashamed to admit this, but I had to go home and get changed to come to church. See, I'd originally planned on going fishing this morning. And she said, oh, okay. And he said, yeah, my father told me I couldn't, though. And she said, well, that's good. Good for your dad. So did he explain to you why it was important that you came to church today? And he said, oh, yes. He made it very, very clear that there just wasn't enough bait for both of us to go. So dad might have kind of missed the point of the command that day, I suppose. It's not an uncommon problem, is it, when people miss the point of the commandments? Some point to the fact that there are so many commands to keep. Most scholars will tell you there are 613 commands to keep in the Pentateuch alone. Many of these you might think of as redundant. For example, if you look at the list of the 613 commands, of course, thou shalt not worship graven images is listed, one of the Ten Commandments. But there's also a command that says, don't teach others to worship idols. You would think that kind of goes without saying. If we're not to worship idols, we shouldn't be teaching others to worship. But that's part of the original 613. Some other commands you and I are probably more familiar with, but the world around us might not be. For example, command to live in temporary housing during the Feast of Tabernacles, something we've all done for many years probably, but that's probably a little bit of an unfamiliar concept to others. Still, other commands are perhaps even more obscure. This is one that I have to admit I'd probably glossed over. There's a command that if a man felt that his wife had been unfaithful to him, he was supposed to come have a meal offering before the priest. That was one command. But there was a separate sub-command in there that said he must not use frankincense in that meal offering. It's one of those actual 613 commands that most Bible scholars will list. I have to admit, that was, like I said, one I was not very familiar with. So it got me to thinking, with all these commands, what's the most difficult command to keep? Well, I guess that's a subjective question. You could look out in our prison system around us, and you probably see that it's filled with people who may be in a moment of rage, lost their cool, took someone else's life. But yet that same person could never, ever think of dishonoring their mother and father. Likewise, how many people could never ever think of taking a life? But dozens of marriages are broken up via people committing adultery. So the command, or the question of which command is the most difficult to keep, I think is a tricky one. But it's one I'd like to explore today. What is the most difficult command to keep? What is the most difficult command to keep? With that in mind, knowing and understanding that there were at least 613 commands at the time, we can understand why the young man had the question to Jesus Christ, which is the greatest command. Go ahead and turn to Matthew 22, if you would. Matthew 22. We'll pick it up in verse 34. Matthew 22, verse 34. It says, "But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. Then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him and saying, 'Teacher, which is the greatest command in the law?'" So this is after Christ had kind of put the Sadducees in their place with the questions they had. This young man came to Jesus Christ. Now, maybe he was trying to trip Jesus Christ up. Maybe he was trying to see, well, let's see if I can trick him into giving me an answer that I can, you know, catch him in something in. Or maybe it was a legitimate question. We don't really know. We do know, though, that the answer Christ gave was a legitimate answer. Christ said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." Now, this would not have been a new answer for a scribe or a Pharisee or anyone to have heard. Christ is actually quoting directly from the Old Testament. It's Deuteronomy 6, verse 5. These were words that he had heard many years ago, or they're words that have been spoken, you know, over 1,000 years ago. The theme continues then. Verse 38, he said, "This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Again, these weren't new words. You can find this exact wording in Leviticus 19, verse 18. And verse 40 says, "On these two commandments hang all the law and all the prophets." This is it. This is the heart and core of the law, is what Jesus Christ is telling him. Just maybe another way of saying the same thing, some might say. Of course, men have tried to do that over the years. They've tried to summarize the law and the commands in many different ways. Saw a Reader's Digest article not too long ago, and it was, "What if God had texted Moses the Ten Commandments?" So the first one might go something like this: "No gods before me." For those of you who text, it's a small letter B and a number 4, which most people have unleavened texting, so sit there and write it all out, right? You might say the third command as, "No OMGs." Now, that's one that's become very pervasive in our society and one that's kind of a personal pet peeve of mine. In fact, we had a house for sale, 2 or 3 miles down the road from me, and I used to drive by it every day. And they had on their sign, handmade sign, I guess it was for sale by owner, big handwritten sign said, OMG, great house. And I just got so aggravated seeing that sign. And on the days I drove my pickup truck to work, I was tempted to do a little off-roading, just flatten that sucker. But it's become very pervasive. How about, "Yo, your M&D are cool." M&D being an abbreviation for mom and dad. Summary of the fifth commandment. They certainly don't convey the weight of the original commands, do they? That's kind of a funny way to put them in the modern vernacular. It's interesting to note, Christ didn't even take and put these in the modern vernacular. He quoted directly from the Old Testament. And he offered them as a summary of the law and prophets. So this talks about the commandments, and which was the greatest. But he doesn't say anything about which is the most difficult, does he? It does talk a little bit about the difficulty of command-keeping a little earlier, though, in Matthew 5. Let's go ahead and turn back there. Matthew chapter 5. Matthew 5, verse 21. It says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment.' But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, 'Raca,' shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hell fire." You could say that Christ showed the commands were far more difficult than just the letter keeping, weren't they? Not killing the person who cuts us off in traffic isn't enough. You can't just say, "Well, I kept the command there." No, we must change the way our minds think. We must make a change in our heart to keep the commands. Thoughts continues on down here in verse 27. It says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." The physical act of adultery is a sin, that's no question. But to look and lust, whether it be through pornography or fantasy, it's the same sin. Christ showed through these two examples that keeping the commands are much more difficult than adhering to the letter. He taught that sin starts in the mind, and we have to address it there. Paul shared a similar thought over in 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Please turn there if you would. Second Corinthians 10. We'll start in verse 3. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 3. It says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh." Paul's saying, this is a real struggle. This is hard. Verse 4, it says, "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ." Just as Christ said, Paul reminds us, the struggle is in our minds. It's not usually the physical things that we have trouble with, is it? It's in our mind. That's where it starts. If we read all this chapter, we see that Paul was defending his authority a bit here. But he points out something very important to us. New Living Translation translates verse 4 and 5 this way. It says, "We use God's mighty weapons, not worldly weapons, to knock down the strongholds of human reasoning and to destroy false arguments. We destroy every proud obstacle that keeps people from knowing God. We capture their rebellious thoughts and teach them to obey Christ." Now, it wasn't just the scribes and Pharisees that had difficulty with this, was it? It wasn't just the people that argued with Christ that tried to find loopholes. We ever try to find loopholes to avoid doing something we're supposed to do? Sure. Do we ever tell ourselves, come on, do I really have to do that? We know we are to love our brother. But how often have we had it happen that we have a brother, maybe even in our own congregation, maybe at church, that we have an issue with, and you say, I love my brother. I don't hate him. I love him. And I'm going to show him that love by never talking to him and going over here. Well, we all do that. Sometimes we find reasons to justify ourselves and what it is we want to do. We try to justify our actions. We even try to justify our feelings. Sometimes we find reasons to not do the things that we know we need to do. And I think this leads us to what I think might be the most difficult command of all to obey. Let's go ahead and turn to James, if you would. James chapter 4. James 4, we'll pick up the story in verse 13. James 4, verse 13. It says, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil." James is reminding us, don't trust in your knowledge, your business plan, your skills, your ability, your degree, your title, whatever it might be. To do so is arrogant. That's fine to make plans, of course. We must always remember, whatever those plans might be, we have to ask that if it's in God's will, that they be done. Christ did this himself, Matthew 26. Notice then what James goes on to say in verse 17. Verse 17, he says, "Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin." It's the old sin of omission versus commission, you might say. If you read all of James 4, and we'll read a little bit more here in a little bit, you'll see how much of it focuses on presumptuousness and humility. Verse 17 is a therefore statement. In other words, because of all these other things we've talked about, therefore, those who know to do good and don't do it, to them it is sin. Matter of fact, let's back up just a little bit and pick it up in verse 7. Verse 7 in James 4, it says, "Therefore submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up." I don't think it's any coincidence that James spends 16 verses talking about humility, bringing yourself into subjection to Christ, only to conclude it with this conclusion he does in verse 17 of this chapter. We can conclude then, perhaps, or can we conclude, I should ask, that pride is one of those obstacles that Paul spoke about in 2 Corinthians that keeps us from doing the right thing, from doing the things we know that we should do? Well, you know, I don't think I need to do anything in this case because there's a whole lot of I's in that sentence. I've made that justification before. Oh, I don't need to do anything now. I don't need to do good now because I already did something else earlier on. It's those types of thoughts that we have to work to bring in captivity so that when we see an opportunity to do good, the obstacle of pride is not in our way. The same principle that Jesus Christ taught about sin starting in our minds and must being addressed there applies here as well. It's really not hard when you think about it, about where James would have gotten this inspiration. You know that James was the half-brother of Christ. And since their physical father, Joseph, seemingly died at a very young age, Jesus Christ would have been the physical fatherhead of that family. And although they scoffed at him during his ministry, it certainly appears that James came around to understand that even all those years when he didn't quite understand what it was his older brother was doing, he respected the example that Jesus Christ lived there in his own house. James saw that. James Saul took the idea, the thought, that sin starts in our mind and must be addressed there, and applied it in this very specific way. How many of you are English Lit fans, at least to the point where you read George Orwell's 1984? And required reading for some of you, maybe so, maybe not. You might consider this the original thought crime, okay? To have a thought in your mind, to not act on it, to know to good, do good and not do it, that's something that only occurs in your mind. There's no outward visibility of that. So how then can we go about keeping this perhaps the most difficult command? How can we take the time to do good even when it's not convenient? Let's reread James 4, verse 7 through 10. This time, I'm going to be reading this from the New Century Version. This is the New Century Version translation. It says, "So give yourselves completely to God. Stand against the devil, and the devil will run from you. Come near to God, and God will come near to you. You sinners, clean sin out of your lives. You who are trying to follow God and the world at the same time, make your thinking pure." We can't be double-minded. We can't serve God and mammon both. "Be sad, cry, and weep. Change your laughter into crying, and your joy into sadness. Humble yourself in the Lord's presence, and he will honor you." We can't be double-minded. We can't try to be proud and humble at the same time. My father-in-law has a little saying he likes to joke around with. He says, "I'm humble and proud of it." We can't be humble and proud of it, can we? We've got to lament the pride that we have in our life. We've got to work to get out that haughtiness. We've got to ask God for a clean heart, just as David did. And notice what it says in verse 10. "Humble yourself in the Lord's presence, and he will honor you." Not talking about we're doing this to be brought up. No. That's the kind of prayer that God loves to hear. If we go to God asking for humility, that's the kind of thing that he wants to honor. And if we ask him to help us to be humble and to remove the pride from our life, He is going to help us overcome that source of our sins. Once we do that, or I should say once we begin to do that, because that is an ongoing process we go through all our lives, what's next? In my notes, I started to write down, we should take the opportunity to do good. And I thought, that's not quite right. You know, Mr. Myers back in Cincinnati doesn't have a whole lot of roles that he puts on us as speakers. But one of the top on the list is no heresy. And that's big on the list. It's been big in the pastoral training classes as well. I looked at 21 different translations of this verse, and you know not one of them says take the opportunity to do good. Not one. The New Living Translation puts it this way. It says, remember, it is sin to know what you ought to do and then not do it. Nowhere does it say anything about time and chance or opportunity to do good. We could apply this verse in a few different ways. We could apply it that we don't want to be presumptuous, make a business plan, and think we're going to go out and make $1 billion overnight. We could apply it in the aspect of if we know that we should keep the Sabbath and we don't, we're sinning. That's actually a double whammy. We know, do I have to keep the Sabbath? Of course, that's a command. But if we know that we're supposed to do it and don't do it, then we're guilty of this as well. But I'd like to apply the rest of this message in a very specific way. And that is how it applies to us doing good to one another and to others. We can't just wait around for the opportunity to do good. When we know that good is to be done, we must do it. This thought's emphasized in 1 John 3. 1 John 3. First John 3, and we'll pick it up in verse 10. First John 3, verse 10. It says, in this, the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother. Our ways become very obvious. Fruits of where our allegiance lies. They become intuitively obvious to the casual observer. How many have heard that phrase before? Intuitively obvious to the casual observer. Okay, no one here has dealt with patent law. All right. Well, when you deal with a patent, that's one of the big buzzwords they use. In my former career, I was an engineer, as Mr. McNeely mentioned. And so we would review different patents. And one of the things they would talk about in a patent is that something had to be intuitively obvious to the casual observer. In other words, you didn't have to be a trained engineer to understand necessarily that if you push something this way, it's going to move that way. You know, any parent will tell you, you don't have to be a parent very long before you can figure out when a child has a dirty diaper. It's intuitively obvious. As Bob Dylan once said, and I'll start using these references, so at least maybe Mr. McNeely will follow them. As Bob Dylan once said, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows, do you? It will be obvious whose children we are by the way we treat our brothers. Doesn't take a theologian. He's got a PhD in theology. Shouldn't take somebody who's been in the Church of God for 30 years to recognize it. Like, hey, that guy must be a Christian. It'll be obvious. Notice verse 11. For this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Kind of similar to the summary command that Christ gave. Again, from the beginning, nothing new here. This is not a new concept. Continuing down in verse 16. It says, by this we know love, because he laid down his life for us. And we also ought to lay down our lives for our brethren. Christ laid down his life for us. Did he do it just because he had a chance? He wasn't doing anything that Wednesday afternoon. He thought he'd just go die on a cross for us all. No. No, he did it because he was motivated by love to do good. Verse 17, but whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? That's a rhetorical question, of course. How can the love of God exist in someone who's all caught up in the material goods and refuses to help his brother? Can't. Verse 18, my little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. The Bible emphasizes this concept over and over and over again. Romans 2:13, James 1, verse 22. Well, actually, we'll go ahead and turn there. It's just a few pages over. James 1, verse 22. James 1, verse 22. It says, but the doers of the word, and not hearers only, but be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. You're just kidding yourself if you're not doing what you know you need to do. No doubt that this is the example James saw of his older brother. We have to sometimes, quite literally, put our money where our mouth is. We've got to take action and do good when we know there is good to be done. I'll begin to date myself a little bit here now. Every now and again when I'm driving home, I start to get this little voice in the back of my head. And for me, that little voice is Tom Selleck. I grew up watching Magnum P.I. through the 80s. You see, I know Mr. McClain remembers this. And if you remember the first few years of that show, he would have this narrative going on. There was this little voice in the back of his head that says, something doesn't quite add up. And that's the voice I hear. And maybe it's just because I like the sound of Tom Selleck's voice a lot better than mine. Sometimes we're on our way home, and you might think about a brother. You might think about a sister, someone who's having an issue of some kind. Maybe they've got a computer problem. Maybe they've got problems with their house. And you think, boy, I wonder how that's going for them. Well, I hope all that works out. How? You know, maybe I should stop and say, well, I don't want to intrude. They probably got it figured out anyway. We start to make excuses. We start to justify ourselves. No, we don't want to be rude. We don't want to just crash somebody in somebody's, you know, evening or whatever. Of course, it's good to give them a call, but let them know. Say, hey, is there anything I can do to help? That's God's Holy Spirit working in us, telling us, you know, here's something we can do good for one another. Take the time and do it. And it doesn't have to be the big thing. It doesn't have to be that at all. How about picking up the phone and calling someone? Maybe someone we know is going through a difficult health trial or some personal issues. Maybe something that they said, well, I've got this going on at work this week and I just don't know how I'm going to do it. You know, we of course want to take time. We want to pray for those people. But what about a text? What about an email? What about a quick phone call that says, hey, I was thinking about you. How's it going? You might be very, very surprised what that can do. A couple years ago, I had an issue at my work, and I just didn't know what was going to happen. And so I was sharing this with a friend of mine there at church, and it wasn't one of my super close friends, but a guy I knew pretty well. And I said, I don't know how I'm going to resolve this situation. And he said, well, I'm going to pray about that with you. And that following Sabbath, he came up to me, and first thing he said, how did it all go? And I said, you won't believe it. And I told him how it all got resolved. And it got resolved in a way that I never even possibly imagined. He said, I prayed for you all week about that. We should take the time to pray. We should let people know that we're praying for them. We should let them know we care. That's good. We can all do at any time. Brethren, when we hear that voice, when we hear that little, still, small voice in the back of our head saying, go, do some good, let's not ignore it. We all have those opportunities. We've all passed them up, and we've all regretted it. But let's not do that. That's the Holy Spirit working in us as a guide, as we're told in John 16. Let's heed that voice. Let's not let pride become an obstacle that keeps us from doing good. Let's not sit around, wait for opportunities to do good. Let's seek them out. Let's find them. Find ways to help one another. And let's not find excuses to keep from doing that. Let's ask God for help to be humble so that we can serve Him and serve His brethren the way that He wants us to. This is something we can all do. And let's go do the good that we know we should do and that we can do, just as Jesus Christ did for us. And I think we'll see that this hardest command really isn't so hard after all.